Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Once again, it's a pleasure to be able to share this time with you so we can learn how to make better choices, more informed choices of what goes into our body and mind. The first study comes from Johns Hopkins University, and it's about green tea. What they found in their research, and it was published in the journal Scientific Reports, is that the compound called EGCG can impact both in the prevention and treatment of fibrous uterine tumors. And these are generally benign, and they occur in a significant number of women. And I believe from my own clinical experience and laboratory experience, this is due to way too much caffeine in the diet. In fact, we shouldn't have any caffeine in the diet. My doctoral thesis was on caffeineism, and I showed that it was very dangerous. But now we're sending people off to school, kids that are taking a lot of caffeine in the morning, energy drinks throughout the day, because they're not getting a good night's sleep. And that's significantly altering their sense of awakeness. They don't have a natural sense of energy. Instead, they have this artificial boost of energy, and that can cause them to be jittery, unfocused, not able to be conscious of what they're thinking and saying, distracted. And unfortunately, if you're not aware of what happens when you have this caffeine in your body, you can say, oh, that person has ADD or ADHD. That may not be the case at all. It just may be an unhealthy diet, too much sugar, refined carbohydrate, and caffeine. In any case, I interviewed a group of 30 nurses for my study, and after detailed analysis, they were all taking way too much caffeine. And the group that was working night shift in hospitals had the most caffeine. Some were drinking as much as 8 cups of caffeine a night. And when we added it up, that was about 300 to 400 milligrams of caffeine. But some were also taking espressos, and that doubled the amount of caffeine. Now today, they're taking energy drinks, which could have 500 milligrams of caffeine. That's toxic. And then over a period of 6 months, by going on a caffeine-free diet and taking green tea, they were able to shrink and eliminate their fibrocystic breast and help with their fibroids. So, just something to let you know, take green tea, decaffeinated green tea, and can help with the breaking of the fibrosis that can occur, can inhibit it. So that's good. Now, the next study comes from Waseda University in Japan. We all know that we are what we eat. We also know that if we eat right, which many of you do, I'm sure, you're going to live a longer life and healthier. And part of that is because how much and what quality of protein you take into the diet. Now, this new research shows that the type of food we consume will directly relate to our health and how long we live. In fact, there's a direct association between age-related nutritional requirements and metabolic health. Optimal nutrition, according to age, can help maintain metabolic health, help your heart, your lungs, your liver, your kidneys, and therefore lengthen your lifespan substantially. And you have to restrict your calories and take in quality vegetable proteins from hemp, from rice, from split pea. There's all kinds of vegetable proteins. But don't take too much. Don't take too little. And have protein 3 times a day, once in the morning, ideally after you exercise, because the branched-chain amino acids need to go into the cells to keep your muscles strong and keep them intact. Otherwise, we begin to lose about 1% of our muscle mass per year after the age of 40. And that's why you see people very shriveled and lacking muscle tone, unless they work on it, in which case there's no reason for you to have diminished muscle strength, stamina, endurance. All right? So, and generally, it's 9/10 of a gram per kilogram of body weight today. That may be a little complicated. So let me just give you a general, and this is not for everyone, but let's just say the size of your body determines how much protein you've got to take in. And if you're an average guy or an average woman in height and weight, with the women it's about 40 to 50 grams a day. divide that into three, so you're talking about 15 to 20 grams of protein three times a day. For men, it's about 15 grams more, unless you're very tall or very large, in which case it could be up to 80 grams a day. But when you eat an average steak in a restaurant, you're eating almost 250 grams of protein, and there's no way for the body to store protein, so it's broken down. It's called deaminization. In the process of breaking down the protein, you create two byproducts, urea and ammonium. That's toxic to the liver and kidneys. And that's why I have found people who are on high-protein diets that have brain fog. And that's why you shouldn't be on animal proteins at all. Remember, you do not need to eat anything with a heartbeat or a face in order to get the amount of protein you require each day for optimal health. And by the way, we have Mr. World, Mr. Universe, Mr. America, who are vegans. So don't say that you need to eat a lot of meat. And yet that was the myth we all grew up with. I grew up with it. You know, everyone that I worked out with had huge amounts of food, thinking, well, got to have a lot of protein. No, you don't. So make sure that you have quality vegetable proteins each day, and you're going to live a longer life. And that's what this showed. All right, this was published in GERO Science, G-E-R-O Science. And don't eat late at night. Now, there's a big problem happening. The number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. Think of it for a moment. For those of you who are X-generation or baby boomers, do you remember any young teenagers committing suicide? I don't. No one did where I grew up. I went to the largest high school in the state. But today, not only are young boys committing suicide, young girls. Yes, according to the University of North Carolina, social stress and not being able to solve problems, what they call problem-solving deficits, contribute to suicide risk in teenage girls. Teenage girls who have greater difficulty effectively solving interpersonal problems when they experience social stress and who experience more interpersonal stress in their lives are at a greater risk of suicidal behavior. And that's according to the research published by the American Psychological Association. The current study aimed to test both experimentally to simulated and real-world measures of social stress. Look, when we were growing up, we didn't have the internet. When we talked with someone, we talked with face-to-face. We had chores to do. We had homework to do. We were responsible. We had to mow the grass and make our room. And we had to do things. We had to study. And we generally did a lot of this alone. But when we socialized, you know, we were socializing with people that we understood and knew, who knew us. There was a bond, a trust. Today, a lot of young boys and girls are learning that the only thing that they can believe in is what's on the internet, because so many hundreds of millions of people their age are sharing insights. And most of these are things that come when you don't have a knowledge of the world or are not capable of critical thinking. But it also comes from the type of environment you've been raised in. I'm doing a study now, and I'm reviewing all the world literature for just one chapter in a book that I'm writing. It's a sequel to Living in the Moment, Prescription for the Soul, which was very popular, and people really appreciated it. And what I'm finding is this. Children who come from working-class families where you have both parents and spend time together, the lessons you learn from your father and mother are critically important because you need a mother and father. Contrary to what a lot of people who don't believe in parents, don't believe in the role parents play and historically have, and the significance of that, are saying you don't need that. Society can raise a child. A village can raise a child. No, they can't. You know, you can try, but you're not going to succeed. You're going to end up with the mess we see today. So I think it's very important that we understand that a lot of professional class, unlike the working class that spends far more time with their children and gives them a lot of life lessons, simple lessons, that are important to learn, are much healthier and are able to deal with life as things come because they were taught by people who've dealt with life issues without being entitled. These are your working class people from all ethnicities. all religious background. And the people having the greatest trouble dealing with life are those coming from parents who are professional class, because they just didn't spend the time or energy on working with their children. They just paid for love. They had tutors and nannies and assistants, but they weren't there at critical times in the evolution of that child's consciousness. And then you think, oh, okay, we'll put you in a private school, we'll put you in an Ivy League university, we'll buy you an apartment when you're in college to go to NYU. That's not how you help a child. And I've counseled a lot of those children. In fact, one of them is a friend of mine who's a billionaire, was, and his child is challenged at every level because he's never had to do anything. He never had to face the real world because he grew up in a community of celebrities and wealth where everything was done for them. They couldn't make a mistake. No matter how stupid their choices were, someone would come in and clean up the mess. They just walk away from it. And they didn't deal with people outside of their clique, their culture. So we have a lot of cultural differentiation in our society today, and that can lead to people not having a true grip on reality. And they're very susceptible to suicide because they don't know how to take criticism, they don't know how to take input from people outside their own belief system. And they're very susceptible to bullying because they're very fragile, because they were taught they were perfect, and you know, and someone was always there to protect them. In the real world, there's no one there to protect you. You gotta do it yourself. So those who grew up with some hard life knocks and got back up and learned the lesson, they had parents that were there to guide them. Life isn't perfect. You know, you're lucky in life if you have a period of time without conflict. But almost always, we face conflict. Right now, depending upon where you live, there's conflict every day. There's fear. You know, you say, well, someone was just pushed in on a subway track. Someone had their throat slit, you know, by a person. Why is that person not getting help? And why are we allowing this to occur? That's a separate issue. But that also creates a constant sense of angst if we don't live in the right place, have the right support system, and are dealing with life and its issues and its inconsistency in the right way. I also suggest that for those who retired, who were sociologists, psychologists, therapists, teachers, why not bring yourselves together with a national network and have one phone number that can go when a kid is facing a crisis and they're thinking of suicide, they can pick up that and call you. And someone of the people out there will pick up a phone and they have a life experience behind them. They can help. Think of the lives that we could save. Just someone to talk with when we're in a bad place. That wouldn't cost anything, and I'm sure a lot of people would rather knowing that they're retired, but they're still meaningful, they're still relevant, they're helping people. That's a great emotional reward and a spiritual reward. From the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, says if you're in the zone, scientists can now measure your flow. Well, plenty of us, according to the study, engage in certain activities that grab our full attention. For some, it might be writing or painting. For others, it could be exercise. Whatever the task, time seems to fly by while our complete focus is on what we're doing. Scientists call this universal phenomena finding the flow. I call it being in the zone. And now they can measure it. The theory of flow was first introduced by a Hungarian-American professor of psychology in 1975. He used the term in positive psychology to define or refer to a very focused state. And the research has also been cited 170,000 times by researchers and is considered key for this field of study. According to the researchers, the flow zone sits somewhere between boredom and fear or panic. It can be found individually, but also has been seen among groups. Flow occurs in the interplay between challenge and skill. Across many scenarios, flow, or being in the zone, is essential for producing outstanding results. So pinpointing where we find flow and tell us a lot about which challenges are the right ones for us and our skills. So for those of you who've seen people perform in the zone, who otherwise normal performance wouldn't get you there, those rare moments where something special happens, when it was a great Hall of Fame baseball pitcher, Roger Clemens, who said that he would get in the zone and all he would see is the strikeout box. He didn't hear the crowd. He just, that was his, he was in the zone. And man, he was accurate. When Ted Williams, who had the highest batting average in the history of baseball, over 400, he was in the zone. He didn't blink. He would watch that ball every single foot that it came to him. As a result, he had the ability to hit that ball. I have been in the zone so many times, and I can bring myself to the zone. And it happened when I was in a race, and it was a long race. It was a 40K, that's almost 26 miles. It's a little under that. Hilly course, hot day, and at the 6 mile mark, first 10K, I was feeling tired. The sweat was pouring off the athletes in front of us, and my buddy and I were seated 76th and 77th place based upon our previous best times, which was still good because these were all outstanding champion athletes. There were no casual runners this race. You don't run 24.8 miles unless you're really in shape, and you don't want to come in dead last, so you generally only got the champions. But then I just went into the zone. I simply said to myself, I'm going to use the sun to energize me. I'm going to use the hills, since I've done so much uphill training, they'll feel like I'm running downhill. I changed my perception, and suddenly I heard nothing. I heard nothing. And all I remember is at one point, passing a group of people who had blocked the road. They were all running together. These were the most elite in the United States in their field, all champion, young guys, 19, 20, 21. And we were master athletes, over 40. And I remember going up over the curb and in front of them, I remember someone saying, didn't we lap him? Didn't we lap him? And then I felt, you know, the tape break, and I had crossed the finish line first. And that was when I was in the zone. I then used that in other races. In fact, all my races, I used it. And yet I would frequently go out dead last, dead last. If anyone in the audience has seen that, been in races with me, or observed being in the zone and how suddenly it changes your entire performance, give us a call, 888-874-4888. Tell what you saw. I think it's important, or if you've been in the zone and had some remarkable experience beyond what you would ever think possible, I'd like to hear your experience, all right? Because by meditation, by mindful meditation, it's a step towards being in the zone. Because when you're in the zone, whatever you're doing, it's going to be wonderful and unique and exceptional. That's the latest on health and healing. And I think it's important that even in writing, I'll frequently go into the zone to do some of my best writing. Oh, and by the way, one other thing can help you if you have cystic fibrosis. Supplementing antioxidants will help. That's according to University of California, Colorado study. It was published in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. And it was a 16-week study with patients receiving supplements. And all the supplements you would imagine, beta-carotene, coenzyme Q10, vitamin E, lutein, and it all was able to decrease inflammation and sustain that decrease. So that's a big plus. We're going to take a break and come right back. Have a lot to share with you. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We're broadcast all over the world, and I try to select themes and information that empower people. When you turn on this program every day Eastern Time at noon, the hope is that you're going to learn something you didn't know. So we have doctors, lawyers, engineers. We have all professions, all ethnicities, all religions, all class types of people listening, because it's about empowering you. you don't hear me covering what everyone else covers. Well, here's something that's going to come at you you're not aware of. During COVID, we were told that the vaccines were safe and effective. They're still saying that. But we've been able to see hundreds of articles, independent articles, that show just the opposite. That the big danger is not the unvaccinated, to the contrary. The big danger is for those who are vaccinated. And the more vaccines and boosters you got, the more likely you are to have adverse reactions, including hospitalizations and death. And this is not a matter of speculation. The people coming in now are the very people who are insulted and attacked and vilified. And these are people fighting back. I've seen people fight back historically with AIDS, saying that this isn't right, we should do this instead of this. And every single one was slammed, and the media didn't cover them except to call them, crazy or selling disinformation. Well, today, the very people, the thousands of scientists who were right, orthodox scientists, pro-vaccine, many of them got the vaccine, are now showing, we just created the worst health crisis in the world history, and it's going to get a lot worse. Haven't you noticed how many people, young people, are just dropping dead of unknown causes? Well, here's the politics of it. We're going to show you Dr. Naomi Wolf, and Dr. Peter McCullough right now. And McCullough and a whole group of the most distinguished medical doctors and scientists in the world took the time with a whole group to examine the autopsy reports. And they found that this is not unknown. This is directly due to the vaccine. 74% of all the deaths in the autopsies were from the vaccines. Now, remember I told you a long time ago about those self-organizing lipid particles that they're finding? The morticians first found them, long, stringy, rubbery band-looking stuff that was filling up all the arteries and veins. And one guy showed that over 600 autopsies he had done, or a mortician, 600 embalmings, he had to get tweezers and pull this stuff out of the veins to get the embalming fluid in. And there behind him was all these samples of what that was. Yet not a single major media covered that story. Why not? Because it would show what are those things. And graphene, it can slice and cut little holes in your microcirculatory system, which causes clotting, which then can cause strokes and heart attacks. So they found this. They published it. It was accepted into The Lancet. And then within 24 hours, it was the most downloaded scientific article in the world. Hundreds per minute were downloading this thing all over the world. And then they took it off. They wouldn't allow it to be there. So they censored it. So truth is being censored, even when it's hard science provable. Now, remember we have up to a 40% increase in overall death, including after the first year of COVID? So suddenly, what are all these people dying from? It's the vaccines. So when you add in this death toll every year, you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of Americans every year are dying from the vaccine, and yet they're promoting this in children. All these people should be held into a Nuremberg trial. Let's go to the clip. You haven't seen it. I'm showing it to you first right now, so you see the truth about how you've been lied to. And just remember, the people who were advocating the vaccine, they could have been doing that out of simply innocence or ignorance. But then think of the ones who had all the resources in the world to do the homework, and they chose not to. Those are the ones who should be held criminally liable. Go to the clip, please. And by the way, one of the worst situations we could possibly have in our public health is for one corrupt group, and I mean totally corrupt group, to have total control over what we do. Right now in the state of Michigan, I don't know if it's passed yet, but if they had the votes, they will pass it into law and the governor will sign it, where they're putting a new law in speech, hate speech, which is anything that offends someone in a way that could be just normal speech. Or you could say something that is true, but it's not in alignment with official policy. And if you don't use the right pronouns, you could be fined $250,000 and go to jail for 5 years. Think that's insane? Think that's Stalinistic, totalitarian, fascistic? It is. And that's Michigan and its governor and its body. California, Oregon, Washington State. Yeah, it's happening. New York State. Why do you think a lot of people are just getting up and saying, I don't need this anymore, and leaving? Well, thank goodness there's a group of very courageous members of the European Parliament representing Germany and other countries, and they came together. And this was just filmed, and you haven't seen this. The World Health Organization, a criminal organization. I've written articles. Go to GaryNoll.com, scroll down, read about the World Health Organization and the FDA and the CDC. They're all criminal. Let's take a look. They're fighting back. They're saying, no, do not allow your country to sign a treaty giving sovereignty over our health to the World Health Organization. Who are the two biggest sponsors? Bill Gates and the Chinese government. Two biggest sponsors, the World Health Organization. They control it. So, let's take a short clip of them fighting back.
Hey, everyone. It's Naomi Wolf of Daily Clout, and I'm here with my personal hero, the physician who most recently helped me not die from sepsis in the hospital by giving me day-to-day guidance. I'm so fortunate and lucky that, you know, once again, Dr. McCullough helped save my life. He's helped to save the lives of loved ones of mine in the past with his COVID protocols. And now we're here to talk about an unbelievable medical / scientific scandal. Welcome, Dr. McCullough.
Well, thanks for having me on the show. And what happened overnight was amazing. And I'm so glad you're allowing me to tell the story.
Well, it's extraordinary, and it's brand new breaking news. So basically, the headline at which I'm looking says, Lancet study on COVID vaccine autopsies finds 74% were caused by vaccine. Journal removes study within 24 hours. And what I will, you know, share with everyone is that some of the most distinguished and highly published people in their field, Dr. McCullough, Dr. Harvey Risch, and their colleagues at the Wellness Company, published a preprint on Lancet of their findings looking at deaths shortly subsequent to mRNA vaccine injection. However, less than 24 hours later, the study was removed. And a note appeared stating very damagingly to the reputations of the distinguished authors, quote, this preprint has been removed by preprints with the Lancet because the study's conclusions are not supported by the study methodology. Dr. McCullough, over to you. What the heck happened?
This is a stunning development. So let me lay the context for this. I was contacted by a graduate student at the University of Michigan School of Public Health, where I'm also an alumni. And we engaged on a project, and I agreed to be the faculty mentor. I was accepted by University of Michigan. This manuscript idea was accepted. And then what we did is we set out to identify all the published deaths that occurred after the vaccine. And this was quite an endeavor because there could be reports of various cases of kidney disease or liver disease, heart problems. Some lived, some didn't, some had autopsies, some didn't. So we started out with hundreds and hundreds of papers, had to search through all these, and we got it down to 44 papers that had autopsies and a total of 325 cases. Now, the advantage that we had is in reviewing each case, we now have, you know, 2.5 years of understanding of the mechanism of what the vaccines do in the human body. And so we were, in a sense, more advantaged than the original authors. Some of the original papers published, for instance, showed death due to a blood clot. But at that time, the authors didn't recognize the vaccines caused blood clots. So each case was reviewed by three expert doctors, including a doctor who's the former president of the Royal College of Pathology, Dr. Hutchinson, so one of the most expert doctors in clinical pathology in the world. And We reviewed them. Three doctors reviewed it. We had to have two out of three agree that the vaccine either was the direct cause of death or significantly contribute to it. The deaths were very tightly temporally related to receiving the vaccine. And it turned out that the majority of them had only a single organ system involved, which was the cardiovascular system. Wow. A smaller percentage, about two dozen or so, is what's called multi-system inflammatory disorder, typically in young, very young children or young adolescents. So the paper was finalized. Everyone signed off on it. And then it started to go through the submission process. So it originally was submitted to the New England Journal of Medicine, which rejected it after a few days. Then it went to the Journal of the American Medical Association, which rejected it. Yeah, which rejected it, I believe, in about, you know, an hour or less.
But what reasons did they give?
The journals say it's not a priority for us, or, right. You know, they don't give it. It just doesn't even go out for review. So then it goes to Lancet. Now, at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, I published in Lancet. I've published in Lancet before as an author. So it's not, you know, it's not an uncommon territory for me. Right. So it goes to Lancet. Lancet has it for about 3 days, and Lancet agrees to have it go up on the preprint server, meaning it's not fully peer-reviewed. And then Lancet said, well, you know, we're going to triage it to a lower journal. And it was almost like a newsletter. It's called Medical Dialogues. And so we respectfully declined that. And so the full paper is under review now with the American Journal of Medicine, another high-level journal. But the commitment to the preprint server, which it would have went on a preprint server anyway, was fine. And so we kept it up on the preprint server, and this, you know, got announced. Before we knew it, overnight, the downloads of the full manuscript in the preprint server were by the hundreds per minute. I've never seen a manuscript. It was literally flying off the shelf because the evidence tables are so detailed on every death. There's, I think, it's 48 pages total of evidence tables. And so it was literally flying off the shelf at Lancet, all over social media. Then this morning we get a notice that you read that said, well, we're taking it down because they said the conclusions are not supported by the methodology. Methodology, you know, we lay it out. It's a standard search methodology. I've done this my whole career, standard adjudication and ultimately agreement. And again, it's autopsy. So there's not too much to disagree with. The autopsy, if you know, show a blood clot, they show heart damage. So the interesting thing that occurred, though, is if Lancet would have done nothing, this would have been up on the preprint server. The paper would be published elsewhere. And it honestly wouldn't have gained the notoriety that it's gained.
Wow.
So now this is all over the world. People are basically crying out medical censorship by Lancet. And the question is, who called Lancet? Who actually raised objection to have Lancet do this overnight?
Well, that's a very important question. Has the editor of Lancet, which under ordinary circumstances, as a courtesy, would get back to people as distinguished as you and Dr. Risch and your third author, the distinguished pathologist, any word from the editor?
No. In fact, no word from the editor, no courtesy editorial communications at all. We started getting outrage from people, you know, all over the world. We can't download the paper. They've stopped the download mechanism.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's just so stunningly kind of flagrant an example of a corrupted evaluative process that is so fundamental to science and medicine, publishing in a peer-reviewed journal. And the fact that there's not even a pretext, but not just that there's not a pretext, the fact that there was a statement that the study's conclusions are not supported by the study methodology. I mean, that's with no examples. Like, in what way? Nothing. Like, they
right. Well, I think what got them was the punchline, the conclusion. The conclusion was 73.9% of cases, when we reviewed them, we thought the vaccine either directly caused the death or significantly contributed. You know, that's about three quarters. Now, in a quarter, there were deaths, and there were deaths that I can recall of, you know, let's say a person in hospice for some reason who took the vaccine and they ended up dying of, you know, their terminal cancer, or somebody who feeding tube and had aspirated, it looked like it had nothing to do with the vaccine. So about a quarter of cases, you know, had nothing to do with the vaccine. And that's a fair evaluation. But, you know, 73.9% is a big percentage, meaning that of those individuals found dead now with no explanation, and they've taken a vaccine, we know now the majority, if an autopsy was done, it would find the autopsy as a cause of death.
Wow. Well, that fills in a gigantic missing piece of what we're seeing all around us, because there are these extraordinarily mysterious cases abounding in which people simply, some of them healthy people, young people, are found dead in their beds. And so let me zero in on the group that you examined. It was, you found that the average time that had elapsed from injection was 14 plus days. So you were really looking at people who died, you know, within a month of having received an mRNA injection. Was that your search criteria for the questions you were asking?
No, it was really death at any time after taking a vaccine. But remember, the context of these papers coming forward is people must have thought the vaccine was related because they got an autopsy and they ended up publishing their results. It just happened that, the mean time or the average time was within a couple weeks. What we don't know, the big concern, is how many deaths occur, you know, 5 months afterwards, six right. months, a year afterwards. This recent case that really got my attention as a cardiologist is a basketball player. His last name is Adamas.
Yeah.
So he has myocarditis in 2021. He's taken out of competition. He actually tweets it out. He said he got effing myocarditis. I try not to cuss in any of my interviews, but he says that in his tweet. And then apparently he's getting a treadmill test to be sure he's ready to go back, and he dies on the treadmill test. Now, let me tell you, as a cardiologist, I have decades of experience. I've never had a patient die in the treadmill test because we have the defibrillator paddles right there. We can actually resuscitate them right away. So the type of cardiac arrest he had must have been incredibly fulminant. And to die 2 years later after myocarditis sent chills down my spine. Oh, my Lord, what type of problems are we going to have now as people, you know, move forward?
Absolutely. So let me also ask, the largest number, the largest category are these cardiac deaths. And you're pretty much the most credentialed cardiologist in America to answer this question. What exactly is the mechanism that leads people a month after getting injected to have heart failure or whatever the damage is to the heart or the cardiac system generally that causes their demise?
There's two major categories. One is myocarditis or heart inflammation. And then the other is progression of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. So let's take myocarditis. Myocarditis is heart inflammation of the muscle. There, what happens is the electrical current does not conduct smoothly through that tissue, and an abnormal heart rhythm forms, and that heart rhythm causes sudden cardiac death. And that explains the deaths we've seen on the European soccer fields now in these montages. A paper by Polycretis and myself, in a stable period before COVID, the number of cardiac arrests we'd see age under 35, pro, semi-pro, European soccer, rugby, 29 cases per year. Since the vaccines, which are mandated on the players, 283 per year. So it's been a tenfold increase. And they're not developing heart failure. They're developing these collapses, sudden cardiac death. And on the field, in the Polycretis paper, of these cardiac arrests, about a third, if we get the defibrillator out quickly, they can be resuscitated. Two-thirds die on the field.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And they're not developing heart failure. And in many cases, there's no antecedent symptoms. It's relatively rare for someone to have COVID-19 vaccine-induced myocarditis and have heart failure. I do have one patient in my practice who went all the way to needing a heart transplant at Emory, and then another one, a young man who's in my circles of advice, where he had a heart transplant at University of Florida. By the way, both programs refused to recognize the vaccine was responsible for the.
Oh, Dr. McCullough, I've got to add a tragic anecdote to these two anecdotes. We were contacted by the family of a healthy young man who needed a heart transplant after receiving an mRNA injection. And they wouldn't give him the heart transplant unless he had another, a booster. It's madness. Well, let's go back to this mechanism. The lipid nano, you know, I'm obsessed with the lipid nanoparticles. They go everywhere in the body. And our team has found that they damage electrical conduction in the myelin sheath. So doesn't it stand to reason that they would damage electrical conduction in a heart muscle as well? Like, how could lipid nanoparticles peppered everywhere in the body, crossing membranes, made up of industrial fats, not cause damage to the heart, I guess is my question.
Well, you know, two important points there. Again, we're on myocarditis, this first major mechanism. The lipid nanoparticles, when they are taken up by human somatic cells, that is, you know, non-reproductive cells, so that would be heart tissue, other organs, they call what's called syncytia formation. They actually cause the cell membranes to fuse together. Yeah. Now, the heart is avid for lipids. So, the skeletal muscles use about 80% glucose and 20% lipid as their fuel. In the heart, it's just the opposite. It's 80% lipid, 20% glucose. So the heart may preferentially take up lipid nanoparticles more than other tissues.
Oh, wow.
Of interest, athletes are always exercising. So myocardial blood flow draws more of these particles into the heart for the periods of exercise. And then on top of that, we know that the messenger RNA, you know, on the lipid nanoparticles is circulatory in the body at least a month in a paper published by Castriuta and colleagues. So we think that exercise in athletes, because we hear disproportionately about athletes going down, and they shouldn't go down, right? So they've all been checked out ahead of time, EKG, echo, we know they're good to go. So the only thing that's changed in life is the vaccine. Now, there's a paper by Flavio Cattagiani from Brasilia, very important paper, that postulates based on all the data, and it came out in our analysis as well, that there are two periods of sudden death in these cases. One is during exercise, where there's a surge of adrenaline, which seems to precipitate the abnormal arrhythmia, and also between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. And it's interesting, during sleep, you hear about young people dying in your sleep, because in 3 a.m. to 6 a.m., there's also a surge of adrenaline during the normal waking process.
Oh my gosh, this is so tragic. And then the second category of cause of death that you found was systemic inflammation. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, it's progression of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. So what we know there is there was an American Heart Association abstract. First author, I believe, was Guntler, and it was in 2021. And he had measured a whole variety of blood factors that are known to be related to triggering an atherosclerotic plaque rupture in arteries before and after the vaccine.
Isn't it good to know that there are people fighting on your behalf? Now, you should also let your legislator know. You don't want to be a part of that. Don't let the World Health Organization's treaty be signed. You got a lot of people wanting that signed because they want total control over your life. That's unfortunate. Now we're going to go to another clip of the multi-award-winning documentary, in fact, the most winning documentary from the International Independent Film Festivals in the world last year. Not a word about it, not a review, nothing anywhere else. Why? Because it told the truth. And it's not me telling the truth. It's the journalist and the members of the International Group of Independent Investigative Reporters. So finally, the truth about AIDS is being compared to the lies about COVID. The same people like Fauci, who controlled the war on AIDS, controlled COVID. They use the same playbook. Anyone dissent, attack them. All right? Discredit them. Destroy them. That's what they did. But now the people they've attacked and tried to destroy are fighting back and making major progress. Let's go to clip 3. The cost of denial.
He has had blood workup done every 6 months for 8 years. So we have before, during, and after blood workups showing from AIDS, not just HIV infection, from AIDS, and one guy who couldn't be here this morning, he's stuck in traffic, we just found out, and at some other time you might want to interview him, he had 22 different life-threatening illnesses. He had endocarditis, he had encephalitis, he had Kaposi's sarcoma, he had pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, he was in St. Vincent's Hospital near death on several occasions, and today he is completely healthy also. Now, you were with him, you know him, you've seen his records, I have his records. So I would only make statements about people that I have their medical records that are open for people, any
people want to see it. Well, I asked Al and you to bring medical records along today, so whatever statements are made, I would have evidence in presenting them to this audience that there was some type of paper trail, medical right. paper trail, in terms of what you're stating. Now, Al, you were diagnosed with what is called AIDS in 1989.
That's right.
Tell us about yourself. Do you have any idea what caused your immune deficiency?
Yes. I was an intravenous drug user back in the early 80s. I must have made contact with the AIDS virus maybe probably 14 years ago. I stopped using drugs over 10 years ago, intravenous drugs.
Was this after you were diagnosed?
A little before I was diagnosed, I stopped using drugs. Then 2 years after, I went for a doctor's checkup. Doctor advised me to take a HIV test because I had a swollen lymph nodes glands.
Swollen lymph?
Yes.
Lymph node?
Yes. Uh-huh. And also, I was losing some weight. I was getting weak. So I took the HIV test, and it turned out to be positive. So I panicked. I said, wow, I don't want to die. I'm very young.
How old were you?
I was like 30, 32 years old. Anyway, I said, I don't want to die. So I started going to the doctors. And the doctor says, well, took a blood test. My T-cell count was at 800. So that's pretty good.
That's very
T-cell
good,
count.
800. Mm-hmm.
So right away he says, take this, we're gonna give you a prescription of ACT. I said, but from what I gather, I think I'm pretty healthy still to take these toxic drugs that you're prescribing me. So I just started doing some research. And Dr. Noel was on the air one day. I was listening to him. There was so much information he was giving out as far as alternative approaches to AIDS and any other diseases we get.
How long did you stay on AZT?
Well, he did prescribe me the ACT drug, and I did take it for a week or two.
So you didn't use it very long?
No, I took it for a week or two because I started getting sick off of it. I started getting blurry vision, and I started, my body was starting to change. I felt something taking over my system.
Did you get your CD4 count, your blood count, after you took the AZT?
No, this was before.
But after you did take it, did your blood count,
yes,
did your count go down, CD4
yes,
count?
Yes, it did.
What did it go down to?
As a matter of fact, it went down to 600 then.
Went from 800 to 600?
Yeah.
In a short period of time?
In a short period of time. So I just didn't feel good. My body I was being drawn. So I put the drug in, just put it in the garbage can. I just didn't want to take that.
Now, after you got with Dr. Null, and you then got involved in his program using his protocol?
Yes.
Now, what happened to you health-wise after you got involved in his program?
Well, right after I started doing his protocol, my lymph nodes went down. Now I'm completely normal. They're down. I don't feel anything. I had them for years.
How long have they been down?
4 years.
4 years?
4 years, yeah.
And how long did it take after you started the program with Dr. Noel before they went down?
It took me about a good 6 to 8 months mm-hmm. since they started. I started detoxifying my system, and I just improved my health. I gained weight, for one. and I feel great right now.
Now, these are medical records you brought with you today.
That's right. You have 12 copies of my medical records there.
What do these medical records
prove? Well, one is a PCR test. PCR test indicates the viral low level, HIV viral low level. It's negative.
What does that mean?
That means that there is no HIV virus in my system. It's out. They can't detect it in a blood test.
There are many tests that he's taken. It's not just one test. I ask individuals to test when they're at this level almost every 2 to 3 months for at least a year. And the reason I do this is because other physicians and public health officials should know that there's good science in the alternative perspective. And it may not be a therapy that they're familiar with because they're just not trained in it. But if the results are positive and you can document them and you have good medical blood workups, I mean, the blood workups are done at all the standard labs, and the physicians are all board certified physicians who are actually overseeing and administering the actual therapy, then either they say yes or no. But I went one step further. 2 years ago, I decided to get all the patients I could find in the country, not just ones I've helped, but any doctor's help. So I called over 600 physicians and I asked them, do you have any patients that you've treated using alternative non-toxic therapies for AIDS? And many did. And I had a press conference in New York City. We had the scientists, the physicians, and the patients with their medical records, all of which had been pre-reviewed to make sure they met the criteria of having had AIDS, not just HIV infection, but AIDS, and had made major progress, not necessarily to the degree of this man, and others where they've actually seroconverted, meaning you cannot find, not only can you not find any HIV in his body now, you can't find antibodies.
On our last program on the subject of AIDS, we talked with Steve Atkins, a former HIV positive patient who, according to health department records, has converted to negative. He was introduced to us by nutritionist journalist Gary Null, who was instrumental in Atkins' AIDS treatment. And once again this morning, we're joined by Mr. Null and a HIV positive couple who want to keep their true identities a secret, so we're going to call them Joan and Jack. And later, we'll be joined by Michael Elner. He's the head of a group called HEAL, a group set up to help AIDS patients. Welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
The last time we were here, of course, we had Mr. Atkins on, and he showed his record, and things sort of just popped loose since then. We've been getting a lot of phone calls. But before we get into this interview with our other guests today, I'd like to get your view of the latest breakthrough, the headlines, the papers this week.
What breakthrough? I mean, we're not in the ice ages. This is an embarrassment. And unfortunately, this is exactly the kind of propaganda that the media has allowed to perpetuate as if this is the most exciting thing happening. Why didn't the media cover the story that ozone in vitro, same test tube, kills the AIDS virus? Linus Pauling's Institute of Virology showed that vitamin C can kill the AIDS virus, glutathione. There are many, many different things that have been shown to do this. And I'm concerned that people will once again start looking for a drug combination and forget that we have live human bodies who have gone from having AIDS to normal, who've been HIV positive, who've never converted into AIDS, and who have gone from HIV positive to seronegative. I have two of those here. Now, this should make a headline. This won't get any attention. But in a test tube, suddenly that makes headlines. To me, that's absurd.
We get to our guests today. We'll call them Jack and Joan because they do not want to be identified. And we're going to talk to them about their conditions, and then maybe you can tell us what's being done to help them. To our guests who are in silhouette, Jack and Joan, when did you discover that you were HIV positive?
I would say about a year and a half, 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And I might point out that you're married. You're
yes.
Both married.
Yes.
Now, what led to that discovery?
Well, for a while I was feeling sick. At one time I was using recreational drugs for a while, and for a while I started feeling myself really physically tired, lost of weight. I didn't have much energy, and I figured maybe because of my lifestyle in the past, I decided to take the test and to find out that I was positive.
And did your wife decide to do the same thing? Did you tell her you were positive and Then she went and took the same test?
Yes, I found out first, and when I found out I was positive, I told my wife to get tested because I had the fear that she was positive.
Now, how long ago was this?
This was about...
About a year and a half.
Okay, and you started taking what kind of treatment?
I had went to a doctor, and they prescribed AZT. And I was on AZT for approximately 6 weeks, and I didn't feel much of a change. In fact, I was still tired. I still had the weight loss. I was hearing a lot of negative things about it, as well as feeling negative things about it. And I had attended a seminar and decided to get off the AZT, and I took a nutritional route. And I just made a big change in my diet. Big change in my diet, big change in my lifestyle. I had cut out a lot of things, and it seemed to help a lot. I started feeling a lot better.
Now, what's the prognosis for both of you today?
Well, I just want to say that I started out, you know, the first thing they tell you to do is to have your cell count taken, and I went from a 600, which is below normal, to 1,000, which is a normal cell count for anyone who is even not HIV, in, I guess, you know, less than a year. I too, well, we went to Gary's seminar and cut out everything as far as anything that would be bad for you: sugar, caffeine, drinking, smoking. I even stay away from passive smoke. We just follow a very, very healthy diet, and I can honestly say I feel in well health. And my husband went from a having like no T cells to a very positive test now that I guess Gary will explain to you that it's not active at all.
Well, there you have it. And by the way, tonight on the Progressive Commentary at 7 o'clock, Scott Ritter is my guest. I know of no one in the world who is more aware of what's happening in the Ukraine conflict with Russia than Scott Ritter, because he knows the military side of it. He knows the weapons of mass destruction. He knows all this. He also knows the history of how this conflict occurred, none of which are you going to get from the mainstream media. So that's tonight, 7 o'clock. You won't want to miss that. And next week is going to be my debate. I'm having a debate next week on the Progressive Commentary Hour. I'll talk about that next week. Well, that's our program for today, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.